take notes, not to have people scribbling, to listen from a very, very quiet, from your place of zazen. And it's not that I want you to be really busy with this, but it is okay if you would like to take notes and bring a notebook if you are so inclined. It's also fine not to. Would anyone like next week, I didn't really think of it this time, but to have a separate sheet with the Heart Sutra on it that you could make notes on? Is that something people would like to have, so you don't just have the chant book to look at? Okay, I'll bring some next time. So, the Heart of Great Perfect Wisdom Sutra, to use its full title, is the most frequently chanted text in Zen monasteries and practice centers throughout the world. And it's probably the most well-known text throughout the Mahayana Buddhist world. In the Buddhist traditions of China, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, and Tibet, parts of other countries as well, and here in North America and Europe. Not so much North America and Europe. In the more traditional Buddhist cultures, it's often chanted as a dharani. A dharani is sort of an invocation or an incantation used for its spiritual power to protect and support. Many people chant it without understanding its deep meaning and without any particular expectation that they should. They chant it for its dharma power. In traditional Asian Buddhist cultures, the primary practices of lay people have been considered to be sila, or right conduct, and dana, or generosity. The cultivation of meditative concentration and insight was considered to be the province of the full-time monastics, the monks and the nuns. But here in the West, most people come to Buddhism through an interest in meditation. We want to learn to have a quiet, peaceful mind. Or else we're really, really keen to get enlightened, so we don't have to deal with our neuroses anymore. We may not be particularly interested in reading ancient Buddhist texts, let alone chanting them. And if we do chant them, we tend to want to know what we're chanting and what it means. We come from a culture of rational materialism, and we like things to make sense. We need to understand. So we're a bit uncomfortable chanting things in languages we don't understand, or even in English, chanting form does not differ from emptiness, emptiness does not differ from form. What does that mean? So from time to time, we do talk about these ancient texts. And periodically, it's good to take a close look at the Heart Sutra. It's only one page long, as you can see in translation. But it is a condensation of the very core teaching at the heart of Mahayana Buddhism. So over the next 4 or 5 weeks, I'm not quite sure how long we'll take, we'll go through it line by line and see what it reveals to us. We'll touch on some issues of language and translation as we go, but I don't want to be overly academic about this. I'm no scholar of Sanskrit or Chinese, so I can only rely on the work of others, taking it all with a grain of salt, because scholars are notorious about disagreeing with each other. I will give you some background and some keys, I hope, to unlock what the Heart Sutra is saying. But mainly I want to make this teaching relevant to our daily lives and our practice. So let's start with a little bit of background and historical context. It's helpful to see the Heart Sutra in the context of the development of Mahayana Buddhism. In the first centuries following the Buddha's life, many schools of Buddhism sprang up. They really proliferated. And sometimes in the same place. It's not that they were in separate monasteries. There were people in the same monastery practicing different practices and schools of thought. And around the time of the beginning of the Christian era, a school of practice arose that emphasized wisdom, or prajna. And it also emphasized the ideal of the bodhisattva. Bodhi means awakened, awake, or enlightened, or enlightening. Sattva means being. So a bodhisattva is a being who forgoes the attainment of ultimate Buddhahood to aid others, to be free from suffering. And bodhisattvas are notorious for appearing in many different forms. There's about 14 or 15 or 16 forms right here. The path of the bodhisattva had always been part of the Buddha's teaching from the beginning, but in early Buddhism it was seen as such an arduous path that very few people could follow it. So the innovation of the Mahayana teachings was to see that each of us has the capacity for bodhicitta. Bodhicitta means the mind of awakening, that intention or desire to awaken to benefit others. So we each have that capacity for bodhicitta to arise within us and to guide our lives. The Mahayana movement arose in part in response to the tendency of some of the schools of Buddhism to get mired in academic analysis. And the Heart Sutra particularly addresses one school called the Sarvastivadins that believe that phenomena have an essential reality or distinct existence. And this was seen by the Mahayanans to be contrary to the Buddha's teaching. So you'll see later how the Heart Sutra is kind of an answer to that trend. The Mahayana teachings generated a body of scriptures, and one cluster of those scriptures was called the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, or the Prajna Paramita Sutras. And the earliest ones dated from the first couple of centuries of the Christian era, and then longer and shorter versions continued to be written for the next 500 years. So they span, the Prajna Paramita literature spans hundreds of years. The Heart Sutra is a highly condensed version of these teachings. But for all its popularity, no one really knows exactly when or where or by whom it was written. The earliest record of it is apparently a Chinese translation by a Central Asian monk named Jurjen from the early 3rd century. And this was a time when Buddhism was really flourishing in what's now Afghanistan and northern India. So he was probably ethnically from a kind of Central Asian tribe. Because the written records were so incomplete, there's a difference of opinion among scholars as to whether the Heart Sutra was composed in Sanskrit and translated into Chinese, or composed in Chinese and later translated into Sanskrit and taken south again. At that time, cultural exchange was flowing both ways quite vigorously. I think the majority opinion is still that it was originally Sanskrit. But there's no concrete evidence. But the Heart Sutra didn't become really well known until the 8th century, when the Chinese monk Xuanzang made his famous journey to India back and back along the Silk Road. This became the subject of fictional accounts, even movies. He's quite legendary, but he was a historical figure. He apparently chanted the Heart Sutra repeatedly to ward off demons, dust storms, and bandits. So the Heart Sutra was popularized as a protective chant because of these tales about his journey. He made his own translation, which became one of the very popular translations. And since that time, there have been other translations, and there have been many, many commentaries in many languages now, including English. Some of the commentaries that I've read and have been using in my study are on the kitchen table, if you want to take a look afterwards. It's one by Shohaku Okumura, who was Michael's and my first Zen teacher in Japan. It's one by Thich Nhat Hanh, the wonderful Vietnamese Zen teacher. Translation by Red Pine, who's an American translator. Originally, his birth name is Bill Porter, but Red Pine is his translator's name. And my Korean isn't very good, Moo Sung, a Korean teacher. So there's an assortment of commentaries if you're interested in learning more. And also a very irreverent commentary by Hakuin Zenji, the 18th century Japanese Rinzai master. I'll probably read you some excerpts from that later on. And I'll be calling on all of them to help me along the way. But let's start. Let's start at the very beginning with the title, Heart of Great Perfect Wisdom Sutra. The translation we used to use was Great Wisdom Beyond Wisdom, Heart Sutra. So I still have a kind of fondness for that version, which is actually closer to the word order of the Chinese and the Sanskrit. When we chant, you might want to just take a peek at page 5. What we chant sometimes is this version, which is in what's called Sino-Japanese, which is Chinese given a Japanese pronunciation. So that's what they chant. So in Japan, they don't chant a Japanese translation of this. They just give it a Japanese pronunciation. They also give, there are certain phrases that are actually the Sanskrit given a Japanese pronunciation. So Maka Hanya Haramita is Maha Prajna Paramita. That's the Sanskrit given a Japanese pronunciation. And then Shingyo is Chinese for Heart Sutra given a Japanese pronunciation. Sounds a little complicated, but I meant to bring a couple of Japanese chant books for people who want to see what it looks like in a Japanese chant book. But I forgot, so I'll try and remember to bring them next week if you'd like to see them. So the very first word is straightforward, Maha. in Sanskrit means great. The second word, prajna, means wisdom. In Buddhist thought, there are three kinds of wisdom. The first is mundane wisdom. This is the wisdom of our everyday life, by which we make distinctions between permanence and impermanence, self and other, wholesome and unwholesome. To function in this, in our daily lives, we need to be able to make distinctions, and that's, we need mundane wisdom to do that. But if that's all we know, we become trapped and rigid in our views, and dualistic in our views. So the second kind of wisdom has been called metaphysical wisdom. With metaphysical wisdom, we realize that what we conventionally see as permanent is actually impermanent. What we see as ourself is actually not a self. What we think of as pure and good is only provisionally so. But this kind of wisdom, too, can trap us into another version of rigidity. If we think only in terms of metaphysical wisdom. So the third kind is called, we could call transcendent wisdom, or wisdom beyond wisdom, which recognizes that both the relative and the absolute perspectives of the mundane and the metaphysical kinds of wisdom, both are simultaneously true and not true. So this is the territory of the Heart Sutra. This is the wisdom beyond wisdom that the Heart Sutra is talking about. And then the word paramita is used to express this wisdom beyond wisdom. According to which scholarly etymology you consult, paramita can mean like a pinnacle or perfection, or it can mean going beyond, transcending. Or in some commentaries, it's called leading to the other shore. So prajna paramita is usually translated as the perfection of wisdom. Prajna paramita is also the name given to a mythical or archetypal female figure who is considered to be the mother of all Buddhas. You don't hear about her very often, but she's prajna paramita is considered to be kind of the womb that gives birth to Buddhas. It opens us to our Buddha nature. Shin in the title is a translation, or shin or heart. It's a translation of the Sanskrit word hridaya. I don't know how to pronounce Sanskrit very well. Is that close? which means heart or core. And when it's used in titles, it indicates a summary. So like we said, this is a condensation. Reader's Digest version. As I mentioned, the word sutra is generally used for Buddhist texts, and most often for the very earliest texts of the Pali Canon. The word sutra is related to the word suture, to stitch together. But the Heart Sutra was only known as a sutra from the 17th century, from the translation that I mentioned of Xuanzang. Before that, it was known as a dharani, so it would have been called the Prajna Paramita Dharani, the great wisdom beyond wisdom dharani. And as I said, a dharani is kind of it's related to mantras. It's a chant used to generate spiritual power. So that's the title. The text itself begins by setting the scene. Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. So I think it's very significant that this teaching is delivered by Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, not the Bodhisattva of wisdom, the Bodhisattva of compassion. There's another Bodhisattva of wisdom. He doesn't figure here. Avalokiteshvara is the one who is teaching us, offering this teaching to us. Whether deep wisdom opens into compassion or deep compassion opens into wisdom, or whether they arise simultaneously, the two qualities are considered the wings of our practice. So without both in balance, we can't take off and fly. The name Avalokiteshvara can be translated as one who looks down, implying looking down with compassion on the suffering of beings in the world. Now, apparently in some Sanskrit versions, it's spelled with one letter difference, Avalokiteshvara, and those versions have been translated into Chinese as one who looks down onto the sounds or the cries of the world. And this became in Japanese Kannon or Kanzeon. Those of you who are familiar with a chant we do called the Enmeijuku Kannon-gyo, we'll recognize that version. And Meijuku Kannon-gyo is literally the long life 10-verse Kannon Sutra. Now before I go on, I'm going to digress a little to say that wisdom is only one of actually six paramitas that play a really central role in Mahayana Buddhist teaching. Oh, it stopped. Good. the paramitas are dana, generosity; sila, morality or right conduct; kshanti, patience or forbearance; virya, vigor, energy; jhana, concentration or meditation; and prajna, wisdom. These are qualities that we cultivate in our practice, and they're also spiritual practices in their own right. They overlap, for those of you who are familiar with the Eightfold Path taught by the Buddha, some of them are the same, they overlap. And in the same way as the elements of the Eightfold Path do, they interpenetrate and support each other. So the reason I'm mentioning this is we're going to be talking a lot about wisdom, about prajna, because that's what the Heart Sutra focuses on. But we need to always remember that wisdom without the support of the other paramitas will become rigid and lifeless. And the other paramitas without wisdom become unbalanced and self-focused. So we really, we could do another whole series on each of the paramitas, and we might do that. But so just to put in a plug for all the other paramitas before we go on. Now back to Avalokiteshvara, who is deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, and through direct experience in meditation, sees that all five aggregates are empty. Aggregates is a translation of the term skandhas. And from now on, I'm just going to use skandhas, because frankly, aggregate sounds just a little bit too much like cement. I'm not fond of the translation. In fact, the earlier version that we used of this, it just said skandhas. We switched versions. And now it's aggregates. Skanda is a hard word to translate, so I think it's best left as it is. Skanda, it literally means apparently trunk, like a tree trunk, or a bundle, or cluster, like a bundle of firewood. So the five skandas are a construct, they're a cluster of concepts, which in Buddhist thought describe a kind of model of how the mind is put together, or how we experience the world. So just like Freud's ego, id, and superego, they don't really exist. They're just labels that may or may not help us understand the way our mind functions. So the five skandhas are form, rupa, sensation, vedana, perception, sanjna, formation, sanskara, and consciousness, vijnana. Now they sound pretty abstract. So let's see if we can articulate what they are. First one, form, that's pretty easy. Form refers to all that we usually attribute materiality to. That looks pretty solid. So that's a form. This is a form. That's a form. But we know they're not really so solid. Our most intimate relationship to form is to our own body. The other four skandhas pertain to what we usually call mind, but in fact are not separate from form or from our body. Sensation refers to our most basic response to a stimulus, our initial assessment of an encounter as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Pleasant. Perception is how we notice, name, and conceptualize the sensations we experience. We do this through both image and language. Wet. It's kind of a honey color. It's tea. It's kind of minty. Our perceptions are conditioned by our past experience, which means they can be distorted if our the way that we kind of encode or remember our past experience becomes entrenched and inflexible. Next one, formation, is also called mental formations. Sometimes this skanda is translated as volition or memory. But both of those words seem to me too narrow to include the full range of mental formations. Mental formations includes all of our emotional and thought patterns, guilt, envy, doubt, joy, kindness, pride, confidence, all the stories we tell ourselves about who we are and who we're not. These are mental formations. This is how we interpret and make sense of our interactions with the world around us. But as we all know, we can be mistaken, can't we? In how we interpret the world around us. Our interpretation of our experience is always partial. It's always provisional. The fifth skanda is consciousness. So consciousness is the matrix of awareness within which all the other skandhas function. And kind of paradoxically, I guess, that awareness is not all conscious. We're calling it consciousness, but much of our awareness and response to our surroundings takes place beneath our ordinary conscious awareness. But that awareness too is part of consciousness. Okay, let's try a five skandhas case history, just to work with this model. Let's say you're a two-year-old child. Just imagine that. And you're out in the yard, and you see a buzzing insect with a fuzzy black and yellow abdomen buzzing around in the flowers that you thought you might pick a flower. And you see this buzzing, fuzzy thing. And you have no previous experience with this thing. So you're kind of attracted to the way it looks and behaves. You see its form and color and movement, and the sensation is pleasant. You perceive it as something kind of cute and interesting, but you don't know its name. You might not even know to label it as an insect. So you reach out to grab it, and suddenly you feel a very sharp, painful sensation. Your experience has abruptly become very unpleasant. So you run screaming to the nearest adult. Your subsequent mental formations about bees will be highly influenced by the way that adult handles your fear and your pain. If the adult remains calm, does not scold you for getting stung, carefully removes the stinger, you know how to do that? How many people know how to remove a bee stinger? Oh, you should know this. You have to look and see if the little bulb of poison is still there, and if it is, you can just scrape it very gently so that the poison doesn't, there's a little bulb, and then it doesn't break and it won't hurt so much. So you do it very carefully. And then maybe your adult puts some ammonia on to soothe the sting and holds you in a very comforting way. And then once you've settled down, maybe you take a look at some pictures in a book about bees and you hear how they work and how they defend themselves when they need to and how wonderful and helpful they are. And how really they'll leave you alone if you leave them alone. And then maybe in a few days, that adult takes you out in the garden again and you practice watching bees. And if it goes that way, chances are you'll grow up without a phobia for bees. You might even grow up to be one of those beekeepers who is so attuned to bees. You might get really curious about bees and want to learn more, and you become one of those beekeepers who have almost no separation between their consciousness and the bee's consciousness. Now you can imagine other less fortunate scenarios for this case history, but I hope it gives you some sense of how the skandhas work, how the mind works. That was also a little demonstration of how to do emotional trauma first aid with children. But going back to Avalokiteshvara, who's been deeply practicing Prajnaparamita all this time, and clearly sees that all five skandhas are empty. Now this word empty, oh my goodness, I've talked too long. You know what? I think we'll put that forward. That's a good kind of cliffhanger place. Empty. So think about that. Empty, of course, is a word that's been problematic ever since the first person chose to use it as a translation here. And we'll talk about that next week because of the, you know, the negative connotations of emptiness as, you know, despair and loneliness and, you know, nihilistic feelings in our culture. But that's not at all what this emptiness is. It's something very, very different. And so we'll take that forward, but maybe just for your a bit of mindfulness homework is to really observe your skandhas at work. Both in, when you're sitting quietly, when it's really easy to, or easier to pay attention, but also in your daily life, to see what you observe. I was going to have you do, I'm going to practice timing this. I was going to have you do some small group discussion. But why don't we just take a few minutes and see if anybody has some comments or questions that they'd like to bring up. Sorry, this is a new device. Huh? That says stop.
Press that.